Next item, Mr. Harris.
So to continue the discussion about monitoring, item 15, Central Coast Water Quality Preservation Inc., also known as Preservation Inc., conducts surface water quality monitoring on behalf of growers as part of the Ag Order requirements. Preservation Inc. submits an annual report of the findings, which is typically followed by a presentation to the board and public. Preservation Inc. Executive Director Kirk Smith will present a summary. Schmidt will present a summary of last year's monitoring efforts for the board today.
Good afternoon again. Sarah Lopez will present a PowerPoint giving a trend analysis of the cooperative monitoring program over the last 9.5 years.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wolf, board members. I'm going to give the first part of this presentation, which, as Kirk said, is an update on the status and trends that the Surface Water Quality Monitoring Program has been reporting. And then Kirk is going to address data delivery and availability via the SEDIN system. As you know, most of our monitoring sites were initiated in 2005 or 2006. Those are the yellow dots on the map. Over the years, a couple of sites were dropped either due to complete lack of water or lack of ag-related impairment. But in 2012, we picked up a few additional sites. Those are the pink dots on the map. And that was following a 303D listing cycle. We were requested to add those to the program because they showed impairment. All of the CMP monitoring sites are located in impaired water bodies, and these are typically water bodies with a high concentration of agricultural land use. We've been a busy program. We're looking at about 54 monitoring sites with 19 core parameters on a monthly basis. We do 3 species toxicity tests quarterly and sediment toxicity tests annually. Those tests, if you'll recall, are the ones where we take a sample of water or sediment, send it to a laboratory, and sensitive indicator organisms are exposed both to our sample water and to a non-toxic control, and we compare the performance, either survival or growth or reproduction, of the organisms in the sample water as compared to the control. We're doing bioassessment once per waiver cycle right now. And then also once per waiver cycle, a supplemental chemistry study, which is a form of follow-up monitoring, usually looking for potential toxicants that could be the underlying cause of toxicity in the quarterly toxicity test that we do. So this waiver cycle, we looked at 39 water quality parameters and 17 sediment parameters. Those were all pesticide, herbicide, and metals classes.
Excuse me, what's a waiver cycle?
I'm sorry, the could also call it the ag order. So we had a 5-year ag waiver, and then a few years of interim monitoring, and then we're in the middle of a...
Okay, so once every 5 years.
Yep, that's correct. So this is just to show that some of the output from the program. Over the years, we have a 2-inch thick quality assurance project plan that's undergone 9 revisions. We've produced numerous narrative data summary reports, which we're now producing on an annual basis. We think that's most helpful for everyone. We produce narrative bioassessment reports as well as submitting electronic data. We've produced several follow-up monitoring reports, and those are to look at conditions that could be the cause of impairment that we're finding in the routine monitoring. A lot of that has focused on organophosphates and other pesticide classes. And then we're also producing every quarter an electronic data deliverable package. That's the raw data that's submitted to the Regional Water Board or to the state via the SEDIN system. So we've delivered 41 of those packages to date. Each package consists of 3 months worth of data. So that's multiple Excel files. Each file has multiple spreadsheets, and each file has tens of thousands of records in it. So it's been a very productive program, producing a lot of data and also a lot of synthesis or narrative reporting output.
Quick question on that slide. Narrative bioassessment reports. There are no reports in 2010, but yet in your monitoring reports, I see a couple of 2010 activities in organophosphates and pesticide and toxicity in sediments. So why was 1 year missing? Just curious.
Mm-hmm. So some of it reflects the date in which the report was actually finalized or published, as opposed to the date in which the monitoring occurred. But there was 1 year in there when we actually didn't conduct bioassessment. We produced an interpretive report looking at past years of bioassessment results in lieu of sampling. So, now looking at some of the current water quality results, I'm going to talk about 2014 average conditions for a few of the key parameters or parameters that we consider key indicators of agricultural discharge and also progress in terms of management. When we talk about the data, we like to start by talking about stream flow, because oftentimes the key to understanding water chemistry is in understanding the underlying hydrology. So we have three kinds of monitoring sites. We have sites that are located on the main stem rivers, and those are typically fed by reservoir discharges. So those are normally larger flows, and it's usually pretty clean water. And then any discharges that come into the water body are diluted by those reservoir discharges, those cleaner flows. So it acts a little bit more like a textbook water body that you might think of. We also have sites that are smaller tributaries to the main stem rivers, and those frequently don't have any base flow of their own. So what we're monitoring there is actually just a mix of the discharges themselves. We also have sites that are comprised primarily of tile drain discharges, and the tile drains are there either to drain water that has leached down through very heavy soils and needs help to drain out, or water that's coming up from a high water table. So it could be water coming either down or up. In either case, it's coming out the tile drain, and we're measuring it at our monitoring site. And that water quality looks different than water of a different hydrology. So in 2014, we had three sites on the main stem Salinas River with no water during any of our 2014 monitoring events. In the past, those sites have had so much such high stream flows that I have trouble fitting them on the same graph with the other monitoring sites. So this was definitely a first for us of not finding water there during any monitoring event. We had two sites with tidal influence, one where we had incoming tides enough to create an average negative or reverse flow condition. We had 16 sites with average flows of less than 2 CFS. That's very, very low flow. 5 sites with moderate flow. And then the highest average flow at the Salinas sites this year was not actually in the main stem river. It was at the sites with tile drain influence. And I'm sorry, that's last year, 2014. Half of the Pajaro and the majority of the Salinas sites show statistically significant declining trends in stream flow, and there were no increasing trends in flow. Except at a tidally influenced site. At our southern sites, which are in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties, we had 3 sites with no water in any 2014 monitoring event. We had 1 site with tidal influence, but net outbound flow. 16 sites with those very low flows of less than 2 CFS. No sites with average flows of greater than 10 CFS. And many of the higher flow sites in the south also have tile drain influence, or I should also add wastewater treatment plant effluent to that. Nearly all of these sites show statistically significant declining trends in stream flow. Nitrate is another parameter that I wanted to highlight. In the northern region, the Pajaro and Salinas units, we had 3 sites with no water in any 2014 monitoring event. Of the sites that did have water, 4 of those sites actually had average nitrate levels of less than 2 milligrams per liter, less than 2 parts per million. And then I apologize if these bullets are confusing, but 4 additional sites had average nitrate levels in between 2 and 10 parts per million for a total of 8 sites with average nitrate levels less than 10 parts per million. And that's not to say that those sites never had exceedances of the 10 part per million criteria, but it is to say that the typical condition at those sites is less than 10, and in some cases less than 2. 13 of the sites averaged between 10 and 25 milligrams per liter, and then the highest nitrate that we saw, which was greater than 25 parts per million, occurred at tile drain sites, with one exception. In terms of trends, 2 of the Pajaro sites have declining trends in nitrate, 2 of the sites have increasing trends in nitrate, and then 4 of the Salinas sites have increasing trends in nitrate. The good news, though, about those trends is that in almost all cases, if we see an increasing trend in nitrate, we see a corresponding declining trend in stream flow. So this is sort of to echo what Pete said earlier about concentration not being the only indicator of progress. In many cases, improvements in agricultural management practices manifest by showing reduced flow or reduced loading. So that even though the ultimate water quality criteria that we're trying to hit is concentration-based, if the overall volume of the discharge is being reduced, we're going to see a reduction in stream flow and a reduction in load. We also know, of course, that some of the reduction in stream flow is climate-related. At the southern sites, we had 4 sites with average nitrate of less than 2 parts per million in 2014, 5 more sites with average nitrate in between 2 and 10 for a total of 9 sites with average nitrate below 10 parts per million, and 8 sites with average nitrate above 25 milligrams per liter. And those were largely sites with tile drain influence. 11 of those sites, though, show statistically significant declining trends in nitrate, with 4 of those sites located in Santa Maria. There were 3 sites with increasing trends in nitrate, and all 3 of those sites had corresponding decreasing trends in flow. So the last routine monitoring parameter that I want to talk about in detail is turbidity, and turbidity can be an indicator of eroded soil and also of resuspended bed sediments. There's no clear-cut numeric objective for turbidity in the basin plan, but I believe your staff often use 25 NTUs as a threshold for concern. And then the category of 25 to 150 NTUs is something that I've used here on this map. It's not so much biologically meaningful as it is a natural break in the data, but I would say that around 100 NTUs is kind of a upper level that we sometimes see even in an unimpacted area in a large storm flow. So those numbers for reference, 6 sites in the north had average turbidity of less than 25 NTU in 2014. All of the Pajaro sites had average turbidities under 150. 5 of the Salinas sites were under 150 on average. 8 of those sites were in between 150 and 500, and 2 of the sites were over 1,000 NTU on average. When we're seeing those very high turbidity numbers, it's typically sites that are experiencing large storm flows or that the local geology is highly erosive.
Quick question. You know, you mentioned earlier the impact of a decrease of in-stream flow. So I would assume, though, that since we do have reduction of in-stream flow and some extreme no flow, you know, you would have less turbidity, because even if you do have highly erosive soil, you know, if you have a very low flow, you're going to have less turbidity.
I agree with you. I think that has to be happening. And my last bullet point here is that these trends, when we see declining trends in turbidity, it's sometimes paired with declining trends in flow. And I don't know if that's because the flow and the turbidity are a little bit more loosely coupled than we think they are, or if it's just because of the way the statistics work out, if there's just more variability in one data set than another. Maybe there are declining patterns, but it's not showing up as statistically significant yet. Could be one or the other. In either case, though, we do see quite a few declining trends in turbidity along with these declining trends in flow, and we don't see any increasing trends in turbidity. In the south, it's the same. It's pretty much the same thing on trends, 6 sites showing statistically significant declining trends in turbidity, 1 increasing trend, which was interestingly coupled with a declining trend in flow. But six of our sites in SLO and Santa Barbara counties are below 25 NTU on average. Nine sites are between 25 and 150. Four sites between 150 and 500. And then two sites with greater than 500 NTU average, where with those kind of high numbers being skewed by storm events. And I don't have time to get into the other parameters, but when we looked at the overall trends for all sites and all parameters, there were a few other things that really jumped out that I wanted to share with you. We had numerous declining trends in pH in the north, and in the south there were fewer trends in pH, and they were mostly increasing. I don't have an explanation for that, but there were enough sites showing those patterns that I think it's worth noting. We have numerous and almost exclusively increasing trends in salinity-related parameters in the north. And in the south, we have quite a few trends in salinity-related parameters as well, but they're almost all declining. So the last thing that I want to talk about is the aquatic toxicity data. And this is going to be a little bit of a different kind of trend that I'm discussing in this table. Previously, I was talking about what would be called monotonic trends, which if you can imagine like a straight line on a graph, this is more of a before-after comparison. And these are not the test results themselves. These are the percent of samples during each of the specified periods that showed toxic results. So for algae in 2014, we saw 5% of samples collected during the year that showed significant reductions in growth or reproduction as compared to the non-toxic control. In the first 4 years of the waiver, or first 5 years of the waiver, 13% of our samples were showing toxicity to algae. So there's been a reduction there in the number of samples showing toxicity to algae. For fish, we previously saw about 5% of samples showing toxicity to fish survival rates. In 2014, we only saw 2% showing toxicity to fish survival, and another 5% showing toxic effects to growth. Whether or not the reduction from 5% to 2% is significant, or whether that's just variability, I don't know, but at least it's in the downward direction. For invertebrates in water, we went from 37% of samples showing toxic effects to invertebrate survival in the first 5 years of the waiver to 26% in 2014, with another 25% showing reductions to growth or reproduction rates. So those for those first three species, the algae, the fish, and the invertebrates in water, which is the Ceridaphnia dubia, we're seeing what looks to be declining toxicity. For invertebrates in sediment, however, it looks like we're seeing increasing toxicity, where about half of the samples in the first 5 years of the waiver showed toxicity to invertebrates, and almost three quarters of them showed toxicity in 2014. So looking at that in a little bit more detail, now we're looking at actual test results. These are invertebrate survival rates for all of the samples in the Pajaro hydrologic unit, averaged by year. And the trend line pretty clearly shows increasing survival rates over time. Same thing for sediment. Although if you look at the difference between 2013 and 2014, it seems to, the high survival rates seem to have peaked in 2013 and have come down a little bit in 2014. It's not enough of a drop in this hydrologic unit where I'd say it's necessarily meaningful, but we see the same pattern in some of our other hydrologic units, which I'll talk about now. So this is the same trend line for the Salinas hydrologic unit, and over time, there's definitely been a dramatic improvement in invertebrate survival rates. But if we smooth out the line, we see that there's been reduced survival from 2013 to 2014. And that's being driven by about nine sites that sort of had peak survival rates in 2013 and have since come down a little bit. We see the same thing in sediment. The Santa Maria pattern looks pretty similar, and that dip from 2013 to 2014 is being driven by six sites, with an overall trend towards improvement, though, since the beginning. And in terms of sediment, we had a flat line and then a decrease from 2009 to 2010. It since came up, and now it seems to have plateaued a little bit. So those were the Pajaro, Salinas, and Santa Maria hydrologic units. The other hydrologic units typically don't show as much toxicity to invertebrates. In the Estero Bay hydrologic unit, that's the San Luis Obispo area, we've seen sustained high survival rates in water, so low toxicity except for 2011. We've seen sustained high sediment survival rates except in Choro Creek, which has recently shown some toxicity. In San Ynez, we've seen sustained or improved high survival rates and sustained high sediment survival, so that's low toxicity. And on the South Coast, we've seen sustained or improved high survival rates in Bell Creek and Glen Annie, recently reduced survival in Franklin Creek a little bit, though. Same pattern in sediment. So by way of a summary, before I pass this to Kirk, we have kind of a mixed bag of status and trends with respect to some of the most important indicator parameters for agriculture. One thing that is clear, though, is that this is a very robust program. It generates a lot of data, and that the monitoring design has proven really successful as far as being able to demonstrate the current status of water quality in these water bodies and also having the statistical power to detect trends. I know that was a big question on everyone's mind when the program started. Would we have the power to detect trends? And I think that over time we're seeing that we do. So I'm going to pass this to Kirk now, but I quickly wanted to preface his remarks with an illustration of the data deliverables that he's going to be discussing. So that big yellow dot represents one monitoring site, and we're measuring a whole host of parameters at each monitoring site during each event. So this is a representation of one monitoring event. A quarterly EDD, or electronic data deliverable, contains data from all the sites for three monitoring events. But that's not all the data. So each one of those parameters for each site, for each monitoring event, has about 40 other pieces of information that go along with it. What time the sample was collected? Was it a replicate sample? What was the laboratory batch ID number? Was there a data qualifier? And all of those 40 additional pieces of information have to be specifically formatted, and they're verified by an electronic data checker. So that's a representation of all of it. I'll now pass it to Kirk.
Sarah deals with a lot of data in this program. 20 months ago, I came before your board and expressed concern about not our requirement to upload the data electronically, but the success of the state CEDIN system to receive the data electronically. We've been working with CEDIN, and the CalDux is the system that uploads it. We've been working with your staff here to make sure that while we know we have completed the monitoring and we know that we have clean data, and in many cases we have delivered the data in raw format to your staff, that we are having problems with how this data becomes available to the public through the CEDIN system. In the middle of last year, toward the end of 2014, the CEDIN data was not available after 2012 to the public, and so it's difficult to show or talk about any of the changes in the monitoring sites. On February 2nd, Chris Rose sent us a letter saying that the CEDIN system had undergone a lapse of funding.
Yeah, your mic was not on.
I'm sorry. I apologize if you couldn't hear me. In February 2nd of 2015, we received a letter from Chris Rose stating that CEDIN had undergone a lapse of funding, so this was a somewhat dysfunctional program that was no longer funded, yet we still had an obligation in the MRP to deliver the data quarterly through this system. I sent a letter to Mr. Harris requesting that we have an opportunity to address your board on this issue, and tentatively arranged for the appearance to be in May. However, it turns out that CEDIN was refunded in May, and we felt that it'd be taking too much opportunity to poke CEDIN if we came in May, and so we're here in July. Well, While there are still many complaints about the CEDIN system, we have enjoyed significantly greater success in our uploads, although it's still been difficult. Although we are not the only entity that has this problem, the State Water Board, on their agenda for August 4th next week, has an item dealing with the CEDIN system, which states in part, if CEDIN cannot accept a particular format or type of data, the regional water boards or the State Water Board may accept that data and information if it meets the formatting and quality assurance requirements detailed by their protocol. There's a CEDIN work group, which is, I hope, you know, psychologically healthy for these people. On March 17th, they met and submitted their comments to CEDIN, and almost all the comments fell into two categories. One, the ability to upload sufficiently clean and adequate data into the system, and two, the ability to find the data once it was uploaded into the system. We recently have as our entity, as Central Coast Water Quality Preservation, have found that the regional data center in Moss Landing that manages the CEDIN system for us has been very attentive to our needs and has worked over the last month or so to help us get the data either uploaded, re-uploaded, or caught up so that it met not only our criteria on the MRP, but meets their upload criteria. The dilemma is that they have created such a difficult system to upload that you have all of these, not just the data itself, but all the indicators that go with the data dealing with the time of day and the constituents in the water, this surface, whether the surface of the soil is wet or dry. If one of these things is not in their lookup table, it rejects the entire set of data for the quarter. So we have a system where it goes through a data checker, and then that's what has been deemed to be success by your staff, that we have succeeded in uploading the data to CEDIN. Unfortunately, in the past, until recently, that didn't mean anything. It meant that it went to CEDIN and it was somewhere, but it wasn't available to anyone. And the reason we scheduled this is to, one, as of today, actually commend CEDIN for improving, but it still seems that they have set up a system that's unduly complicated, and it's as though they have no real clear understanding about who their true customer is. So is their customer your board, in which case you're not getting a service by having the data available, or the state board, or the public, or are all the entities, all the waste treatment plants and everything else that upload data the customer, in which case it's impossible from the comments from throughout the state, from organizations that are huge, like Santa Clara Water, the Los Angeles Waste Treatment Plants, organizations that have huge IT staff and have the same difficulty with this program. Hopefully, the new regimen, or at least our favored treatment that we receive from CEDIN, will continue, and we'll be able to upload this and get the data caught up, or at least the availability of data caught up, because we haven't missed our deadlines, but it hasn't been available to you or your staff. And so we wanted to bring this to your attention as a follow-up from our presentation, or my presentation 2 years ago. If I made this presentation in May, it would be decidedly unfavorable. I am now pleased to say it's better, but there's still a high level of frustration because of the length of time it takes to do something that should be repetitive. And we've been doing this for 9.5 years. We used to do it directly to the CCAMP system here. It was a simpler system. Our protocols were no simpler. Now we have same protocols, but it's more difficult. And if there is a request out of this, is to encourage the state to look into how this process is managed so that all the people that you have required and every other water board is required to upload data have at least the prospect of fairly quick success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt. So, questions?
I have a question. Has Karen Wooster looked at this data? She has?
I'm going to let Lisa. Lisa's here. I think I'll let Lisa answer the question. And as far as data systems in the state, we might as well get out the big ibuprofen bottle and just pass it around the room.
I think Karen has looked at some of it, but Mary Hamilton is actually the staff person that looks at it in a lot of detail and coordinates most with Sarah and Kirk.
Does she have any kind of response or reaction to the presentation of the data?
Are you talking about the analysis, the trends,
yeah,
the data?
Yeah, the analysis.
I don't think she's formalized any response to the status of the data as presented today, and she's not here as far as the presentation.
Lisa, I didn't hear that. You don't think she's formulated a response?
Yeah,
or,
I don't think we haven't provided comments or response or formally. I don't think there's any disagreements or major issues with it.
Okay. I mean, I ask because, you know, over the years we've had presentations by Karen about toxicity in surface waters. And I would just be interested in her reaction to the analysis and potential trends we're seeing and how that is matching up with the CCAMP data that, you know, she continues to...
Well, we can certainly schedule something in the future to have Karen or Mary come back and talk in general. I will caution everyone again, remember 1 year does not make a trend, and we have to think long-term, decades, to see how all this works. And I think one thing the data points out is the very clearly the impact that the drought has had on, you know, and so how that skews toxicity or concentrations, I don't think any of us really appreciate.
Right. And I'm just curious about Karen's take on this, that's all. This is another well-informed individual who's been studying this for years and years.
We can certainly have Karen come back and get a future meeting and give you her take on things.
Excuse me. The trends that we presented today are not one-year trends. This is from 2005, so that makes it much more statistically significant. Karen Worcester has reviewed, and Mary have reviewed this data through 2013. Mm-hmm. So we're consistent with them as far as keeping them up to date and discussing the work we've done through that time.
Good.
Mr. Johnston?
Yeah, I want to commend you guys for the work you're doing. It's certainly tremendously important for if we're going to effectively try to move the needle, to understand the baseline, to understand what's going on in surface water quality. You've come to us in the past, Kirk, to ask for assistance with people who have not been ponying up their dues. And I just wanted to ask for an update on that. Is that situation relatively under control these days?
The situation is more than relatively under control. Starting 3 years ago, starting 7 years ago, the state adopted a fee program that we assessed an acreage charge for everyone participating in the program. At that time, they also adopted a series of tiers that if you didn't participate in the program with us, you had to pay a greater fee, but they never assessed that to anyone. Starting 3 years ago, they started assessing the Tier 3 fee, which would go to people who are doing individual monitoring or people who didn't pay Preservation, Inc., a state fee that instead of being 75 cents an acre was an average of 10 times that much. As a result, this caught the attention of the farmers, and our accounts receivable is now down to 1%. Most businesses would love to have an accounts receivable of 1%. But also most businesses don't have the state as their collection agent to encourage them to pay. The dilemma is that the people who don't pay attention at all. And so while we send them a bill and we send them a follow-up statement and we send them a letter and we send them an encouragement to pay, It's not until they get a bill from the state in June, this astronomically more, that they then call us and ask us what happened. But we've worked with them and we've convinced them that they should at least find the religion and stay with our program next year to avoid this problem in the future. So I do appreciate your help and the State Water Board, the Finance Division's help in working through this. And it's made it easier for us and for them because the number of people in that category has declined to less than 90 farms now.
Okay, so that train's on the tracks now.
Yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Hunter?
That was exactly my question because I know you had come to us in a multiple year period of time with real headaches. And so I'm really glad to hear that that has turned around.
Preservation Inc. has two sets of customers, the water board, but also the farmers who sign up with a program. So you're giving us feedback here, but what's your take on the feedback from the farmers who have signed up with Preservation Inc.? I know they get the newsletter with a report, et cetera, but do you have a sense of feedback there, like, oh, yeah, this is good information, or I'm just doing this in order to meet my requirements under the ag order?
Dr. Wolf, certainly the reason they participate in our program is because of the ag order. On the other hand, we do periodic outreach down with the grower shipper in Santa Maria, the Farm Bureau, and in Santa Clara, everybody in between. Honestly, when the ag order is up for renewal, there's great attention and participation in this process. In between, the people who come to the updates are the people who are actually doing a very good job and want to see how well they're doing. I have to say that there's probably 70% of the growers who have never participated in any of our programs beyond paying us. And as a result, our ability to do outreach and show them ways that they can improve or show them where their areas of impairment are is limited because they don't participate. Unfortunately, I think that's with many societies that you have the top 30% know what's going on and the rest of them are just going down the roads at the same time.
Yeah, it's probably a fair assessment. Thanks. Mayor Delgado?
Yeah, I really enjoyed your presentation and 10 years of data. If we didn't have it, we'd be wishing very strongly that we had it. And it's a great baseline of 10 years to see where it's going to take us. Is my understanding correct that you're out there taking several snapshots a year and you put those snapshots together and you sort of average them in any current year and you compare it to the average of previous years? Is that kind of how you do it?
The toxicity data were presented that way because we only monitor quarterly. All the other parameters we're monitoring on a monthly basis. So when we do a trend analysis, it's actually comparing every month of every year sort of to those months of every subsequent year. It's called a seasonal Mann-Kendall trend analysis. So it's not such a gross or blunt annual average. It's kind of, it takes into month-to-month seasonality.
Okay.
Yep.
And then on turbidity, you mentioned that the Regional Water Board uses 25 NTUs as their sort of threshold, and that your industry uses 100.
Oh, I'm sorry. If that's what came across, then I misspoke. So our data, sort of the next category, if you remove all the data below 25 NTU, the next category that the data naturally break itself out into is about up to 150 NTUs, which, as I said, is not a biologically meaningful threshold other than when I've done work in unimpaired watersheds, I have seen major storm turbidities of 100 NTUs or so, meaning it's kind of a number we still see in nature sometimes. That's the only meaning behind it.
So you said the staff at our board uses 25 as an indicator of Good, no good.
Of impairment to juvenile fish, I believe.
Okay. Yep. So above 25, it's not good for juvenile fish.
Right.
And that in nature, you often see storms at around the 100 NTU level. So then why wouldn't you use 100 instead of 150? Because if it's above 100, then there's probably something going on that's not of nature.
Oh, just two reasons, and maybe it would have been better to break it at 100. One is natural, the natural break of the data. There were several data points that were maybe 115, 125, but not 200. And so I was just trying to class the data for the purposes of showing it on a map. And what was that? Where was I going? There was another answer to that.
Okay, well, for me, trying to understand it, it just...
I'm sorry. And the other response then would have been because a lot of our data is not from large storm events. So when we have, when we have a turbidity of 100 NTUs and it's in July, there's no way to relate that to a major storm. And as I said, a lot of times those higher turbidities are occurring in water bodies where the underlying geology is naturally erosive. But I don't think I could honestly say that we'd expect to see a turbidity of 100 or more NTUs, in the main stem Salinas River with no discharge into it, that kind of thing.
Okay. So I would be left in the future trying to get some significance out of the turbidities with different levels of NTUs. And so I think it would be helpful for me if they were tiered in ways that made some meaningful sense rather than just be numbers.
Okay.
On the aquatic toxicity samples, I want to know why it's additive that you can add survival and growth toxicity percentages so you might get a total. It seems like you're adding apples and oranges to get something that's neither.
The idea there is to look at the number of samples showing toxicity to those organisms, and it would understate the toxicity for me to only list the survival effects. At the same time, if a sample shows survival effects, it automatically shows growth or reproduction effects. So if only half of the organisms in the sample survived, then their growth rates or their reproduction rates, which are assessed at the same time in that sample, if only half of them survive, then obviously there's going to be less production and less growth. So you don't want to double report. So what I'm reporting is the number of samples that showed survival effects, and then added to that the number of samples where there were not survival effects, but there were sublethal effects. So the organisms were still affected, but it just didn't affect their affect their survival rate. So I think it is accurate to say that the total percentage of samples, for example, for invertebrates, that the total percentage of samples was 51%, so about a quarter showed survival effects, and another quarter did not show survival effects, but showed growth or reproduction effects.
Okay, so in that case, 26% died when subjected to the sample?
In this case, 26% of our samples showed toxic effects to survival rates.
Which means they cause some level of mortality to individuals subjected to the effluent or the grab sample.
Correct. It doesn't. Now, whether it was whether there was 0% survival or 25% survival or 35% survival, those are all toxic effects, and so those go into this percentage. But if you were to look at the result of an individual sample, you would see a percentage that represents the number of surviving individuals.
Okay, so in that case, 51% of the samples had some deleterious effect between either survival or growth.
Exactly.
Okay. So to everyone in the room here, my overall comment is when you get to the summary, there's 10 points in that last narrative slide, but it's hard for me as a board member to make better sense out of it. And so a higher level, what's this mean for TMDLs? What's this mean for the ag order? What's this mean for the CCAMP data? you know, trying to tie it all together in my mind, I'm not able to do at this point, but I surely am very appreciative of having all the data. And having it means you have a lifetime to figure it out, which is better than not having it and not having a sense of anything. So I really appreciate it. Thank
you're
you.
Having a lifetime.
That's why I didn't become a biologist. What she just said.
No, that's why she doesn't cover the survival rate of board members. There is one speaker card from Kay. So, Kay, would you please come to the podium?
And while she's coming up, I wanted to, you know, make a suggestion, because whether or not we wanted to, after this is over, move into the first couple items for tomorrow to get a head start. They're pretty easy items, and one of them is something I think Mr. Moore, it would be nice for Mr. Moore to hear about. So just to make sure the board members don't start packing up prematurely, and so.
Yeah, I heard binder clicking, but it's.
I'll bring it back out. Can we take it on the wrong day?
Yes, we can. There, that's in the fine print.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're on a roll, so. Go ahead, Kay.
Okay, thank you. It's Kay Mercer with KMI, and the first thing I wanted to say was I appreciate all the work that Sarah and Kurt do. That the Preservation Inc. is near and dear to my heart. I was involved with the formation. I was on the committee that hired Sarah. I'm glad to see that she's still here after 10 years, actually kind of surprised, because it's what she does is a big job. Recently, Sarah and I have had lots of conversations. This time of the year, we work on farm water quality plans for the growers, and we're working on management practice effectiveness. So I went to Sarah and said, you know, what can you send me in terms of trends analysis in the following watershed so I can tie this back to what my growers are doing? You know, can I use receiving water quality as an indicator of management practice improvement? And it was a very enlightening exercise. So Sarah is working on a lot of trend analysis. She shared some draft reports, and so it was very, I learned a lot. What I learned were there's a lot of variability from watershed to watershed. We also learned a lot about turbidity. You were asking about turbidity, and one of the things I learned is that we have a turbidity standard. We have different turbidity standards. We have one in the basin plan. We have one in the order. We have the analysis. And then I have clients with a different turbidity standard in their tier three sampling and analysis plans. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, moving targets. This isn't a moving target. We just have multiple targets. And so I think the questions about turbidity actually were really good, because as I looked specifically at turbidity across watersheds, I saw so much variability. Sarah's talking about erosive soils, and so I was looking particularly at soils where, I mean, watersheds where my clients are, and I did see a lot of variability, enough to make me think one of the things we actually need for turbidity is a watershed by watershed or some sort of a grouping for a turbidity water standard, which there is precedent for that. We have that with electrical conductivity. There are watershed-based standards, and that might really help us as we start looking at, do we have improvement? Mr. Johnston asked me at the last board meeting, when are we going to see improvement? I want to talk about when are we going to see improvement. I think one of the questions to ask is, how do we see improvement? If we can't really tie, you know, make connections between what growers are doing on their farms to surface water quality, then I think we need to have a discussion about the how, before we really get to the when, because I think that's really important. I hope to work with Sarah in the future. She does a lot of on-the-ground work with growers. She was telling me about some of her experiences. She doesn't talk to you about that, but you need to know that she is giving a lot of assistance to individual growers, as well as trying to analyze this huge program. So I hope to work with Sarah on behalf of my individual growers, and then work with Sarah to put together some outreach for maybe group it, you know, the PAHRO, different parts of the Salinas and the Santa Maria area so that we can fulfill their objective of using this program to also educate growers. Thank you.
Do you have a success story to share?
What kind of success stories?
With all the information being gathered, you know,
I think
people are becoming more informed.
I think Sarah could really give you a lot of success stories if you asked her to talk to you about the work she's doing with individual growers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have success stories with my individual growers as well, what they're doing. But I can one thing, I'm really glad you asked that because this isn't on point to the Preservation Inc., but let me tell you, management practice effectiveness measurement is very, very, very difficult. And we, you know, I'm starting to get pretty creative on trying to find ways to show improvement or show, not show improvement, but to show, you know, some sort of how do we determine that what the growers are doing is actually helping, particularly if we can't tie it back to receiving water. How do we show improvement? So anyway, that's one of the big challenges, I think, with the program right now.
Thank you, Kay.
I would like to see, and I don't know if this is practical or not, at some point as we move into the ag waiver, and I realize that we're waiting for everything to fall into place, but I mean, I would like to see some of that stuff workshopped in workshops that our staff that are wrestling with this, that farmers that are wrestling with this can participate in to just try and, because I agree, I mean, how we measure effectiveness is difficult. It's something, you know, if we knew how to do it, we'd be further along. And collectively, we don't. I'd like to see some of that stuff workshopped. I think it'd be useful.
And just one comment, just the order states that the growers have to show effectiveness for each management practice that's in their farm water quality plan. I can tell you that's not possible. It's just simply not possible. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. One quick success story. You're on the spot.
Okay, you can stop me if I'm beating a dead horse here. You've heard the story of Quail Creek Watershed. Should I continue or? Okay. So Quail Creek is a small watershed. It's a tributary to the Salinas River. There's no base flow that I've been able to detect on that watershed, and I've been up and down it numerous times, all different times of year. So as far as I can tell, the only water that we're measuring when we sample is a mix of agricultural discharges. there's a small number of farms on that watershed, and in 2008, I worked with someone from the Monterey County Farm Bureau to visit with all the growers on that watershed and talk to them about the impairments that we were seeing at the bottom. And then several other people and a lot of individual effort just on the part of the growers worked on management practices. We took a look at what are the impairments that we're seeing at the bottom, and then what could the growers possibly do that would affect that bottom of the watershed monitoring result? Not just show effort, but what could they do that was actually going to change the cooperative monitoring results? And the conclusion, so I'll just give you one success story. The conclusion that one grower on that watershed came to was that they were not going to be able to reduce the nitrate level in their discharge because it was almost identical to the nitrate level coming out of their well. But they concluded that they could discharge less water. So they made some changes to their irrigation, and they put in some water detention basins. And that, coupled with the efforts of a couple other growers on the watershed, led to a statistically significant declining trend in stream flow on that water body. We actually saw it in the monitoring data. Unfortunately, because that grower's moderately high nitrate discharge was diluting another grower's extremely high nitrate discharge, when he curtailed his discharge, the concentration at the bottom of the watershed went up, but stream flow went down. So overall, loading went down, concentration went up. It's an example of kind of these improvements don't always manifest in the short term the way the textbook tells us they're supposed to, but But the good news is we can see it. When we have all the information and we can put it all together, we can see the success.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, so thank you very much. And, you know, I like to hear the success stories because, you know, often we get the negative feedback, so it's nice to hear the positive. And I want to thank both of you for coming today. And I think this was very helpful for us to get an update and see some encouragements on how things are going. Mr. Harris, do you have any comments that
you'd like to add? No, it's great. Appreciate it. Very good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So
and Mr. Moore, you took notes about... yes. Thank you.
So if I could suggest a 10-minute break, and then we can talk about the calendar, I can talk about stipends for the board, and
yes.
The executive director's report, and we'll get out of here by 5 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay, so 4:10, we'll come back?
Yes.
Thank you.